This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm so glad to be back with you on this first Sunday of 2018. We here at Second Look have declared that it's not too late to replay the most listened to stories of 2017. So that's what we're going to do. So sit back, relax, grab some leftover snacks from New Year's Eve, and enjoy some of the best WMRA reporting from last year. We've got four feature stories for you today, and we'll start with the fourth most popular story as measured by number of page views on our website. In December, WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini explored a serious problem in Virginia. Some experts say the teacher shortage here is a crisis, and not only is there a downward trend in enrollment in teaching curriculums overall, but the lack of African Americans in that field is even more alarming at a time when diversity in classrooms is becoming increasingly necessary. Here's Marguerite's report.
Crowded classrooms and less one-on-one attention for students, overworked teachers who also have to serve as social workers and psychologists, plus mountains of paperwork. The situation in Virginia schools has gotten worse.
I think we're approaching what we would call crisis proportions.
Stephen Staples is the state superintendent of public instruction at the Virginia Department of Education.
As of last year, there were over 1,000 vacant positions in October of the school year when obviously students were already back in school. So that's a pretty serious problem, I think, for all school divisions.
Mathematics, special education, and science are the areas with the most need. But the problem is reaching across the entire curriculum spectrum. That includes teaching jobs in elementary schools, which used to be the easier positions to fill. Part of the problem is a shrinking pool of teaching students in the pipeline.
To make problems worse, since 2008, there's been a drop of 30% in the number of college students enrolling in teacher preparation programs in the Commonwealth.
That's Jim Livingston, president of the Virginia Education Association.
What's happening is our teacher pipeline is literally drying up at a time when we are seeing a spike in retirements.
Everyone agrees on a number of factors. There is pay.
Currently, at the end of last year, Virginia now ranks 32nd in average teacher salary, almost $8,000 behind the national average.
There's the cost of training.
Many universities ended up moving to a five-year program where students would need to stay to get a master's in order to get licensed, not what had previously been an undergraduate. And what we're hearing from some colleges and universities is that kids were willing to stay and get a four-year degree and come out and teach, but that fifth year was costly, and they thought that impacted it.
Also, the profession has lost respect over the years.
I can talk with older mentors in the community who can tell me stories about when they were growing up, teachers were kind of on the same level as doctors and lawyers, and now teaching doesn't get that same respect.
That's Tamara Diaz, a former Spanish teacher. She is now the executive director of African American Teaching Fellows, an organization in Charlottesville working to develop and retain African American teachers to support the schools in Albemarle County and Charlottesville City. But there's something else. Parallel to the general trend, African American students are even less likely to enroll in teacher preparation programs.
I have other students who would say, I'm a first generation college student and I have to make it and I have to be able to come back and help my family. I can't help my family on a teaching salary.
According to the Virginia Department of Education, nearly half of students in public Virginia schools are minority students, while only 16% of teachers are non-white. In Albemarle County, a third of the student body is non-white, but only 8% of their teachers are non-white. And Diaz says that's important.
For the nation to be so diverse, for this to be such a diverse community, and to have students say that I've never had a teacher who looks like me, that is impactful.
So what can be done? Statewide measures could encourage more student teachers, whether it be in the form of grants, by taking down some barriers to licensure through loan forgiveness, or reverting to an undergraduate degree.
I think you'll see some of those percolating through policy decisions, either on the General Assembly side or the State Board of Education side over the next few months.
As for teachers of color, the Virginia Department of Education partnered with the Virginia Education Association to set up a Virginia Minority Educator Recruitment Summit back in February. Another one is planned for the spring.
We actually offered six of our fellows a chance. We took them down to Richmond for the Teachers of Color Summit. A lot of our fellows, because we're still trying to increase diversity, they are the only or they're one of two or three teachers of color or African-American teachers in their schools. So for them to attend a professional conference where they could meet other teachers of color was a great opportunity. They kind of got to see role models because they saw people who were in their 40s, 50s, 60s and in education. So for them, they could see, this is what I could do in 15 years or 20 years. Here's how I could still impact education.
For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
Shortly after Marguerite's report aired, Governor McAuliffe announced he was taking measures targeting teacher recruitment and retention. He asked the Virginia Board of Education to issue emergency regulations giving colleges and universities the option to offer undergraduate majors in education. He also directed more than $2 million to improve the teacher licensure process and improve teacher recruitment and retention. Coming in third in our stories for 2017, an important health report. HPV infections are leading to an increasing number of cancers in both men and women. There's a vaccine that can address that, but most people in Virginia aren't getting it. In fact, compliance rates for HPV vaccination are so low here and throughout the U.S. that the National Cancer Institute designated cancer centers called it, quote, a serious public health threat. WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente filed this report back in April.
HPV, the human papillomavirus, is a wickedly common sexually transmitted virus. More than 4 out of 5 of us will be infected with it at some point, most without ever knowing it or showing any symptoms. But for an increasing number of Americans, about 31,500 each year, a lingering HPV infection will eventually lead to cancer. And not just any cancer, the cringe-inducing cancers, cervical, vaginal, penile, anal, plus increasingly, cancers in the throat, transmitted through oral sex. The good news is that there is a childhood vaccine that's remarkably effective in preventing these cancers in adulthood. The bad news is that lots of kids aren't getting it.
It's incredibly easy to opt out.
That's Jessica Keim-Malpass, an oncology nurse and assistant professor of nursing at the University of Virginia. She's been studying HPV vaccination compliance in the state for a few years now.
I became really interested in this vaccine and this issue in particular because we have been doing just a very poor job of getting our kids vaccinated.
Virginia was actually ahead of the curve when the HPV vaccine was released in 2006. We were, in fact, the first state to make the 3-shot vaccine mandatory for 6th-grade girls. But in the decade since then, our vaccination rate has fallen behind 31 other states. As of 2015, only about 1/3 of Virginia kids were getting fully vaccinated by age 18.
Many people say, what good is having a mandate when it's essentially so easy to get out of it? Does it even really do its job?
In fact, state law says parents can opt out at their sole discretion, no paperwork required. But why do so many parents opt out? Keim-Malpass says some parents are just uncomfortable with the idea of vaccinating their little girl or boy against HPV.
Parents assumed that because this vaccine is targeted to HPV, which is in fact a sexually transmitted infection, it may promote sexual debut.
Sexual debut may not be a term you or I have ever used, but you get what she's saying, right? It's spooky to think about this stuff with your 11-year-old. But research has shown that vaccination does not lead to early sexual debut.
The whole reason that the vaccine works is that we are targeting boys and girls before they have sexual encounters, and we know that it works better when we get them at that young age.
In fact, children ages 11 to 14 react so well to the vaccine that the CDC recently reduced the number of shots required at those ages from 3 to just 2. Of course, for some parents, the number of shots is a moot point, because they just don't trust vaccines, to which Keim-Malpass says,
now that the vaccine has been out for 10 years, we know that it's really effective at preventing devastating cancers, and we know that it's safe.
Vaccine skepticism and parental squeamishness may not be easy obstacles to overcome, but Keim-Malpass identified one change that could make a big difference: the doctor's delivery.
If the provider has hesitation about the recommendation, then we know that that leads to hesitation on the parent end as well.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
That's Charlottesville pediatrician Emily Wong.
We have found in our own office that when we gave a better recommendation, there was a lot better uptake of the vaccine than we had expected.
A year ago, Dr. Wong and her colleagues realized they were presenting the Tdap and meningococcal vaccines as mandatory to parents of sixth graders, and the HPV vaccine as effectively optional. Because, after all, skipping the vaccine wouldn't bar their kids from school.
And when we presented it like that, well, no one would choose the optional vaccine. And when we think about what we're trying to prevent, I think that's the most important thing, that we recognize we're trying to prevent cancer. And there are very few things that we have to prevent cancer.
Initially, the CDC recommended the HPV vaccine only for girls, primarily to prevent cervical cancer, which kills about 4,200 women a year in the U.S. Boys weren't added to the CDC's recommendation until 5 years later.
In the beginning, they thought, oh, we're just vaccinating the boys because we're trying to protect the girls. But now that we realize there is a growing number of oropharyngeal cancer in males.
Those are cancers in the throat, at the base of the tongue or the tonsil.
Parents of boys have become more receptive as well.
And you trust the HPV vaccine?
Yes, I've had it administered to my own child. All right, Madeline, well, it's been 15 minutes since your shot. How are you feeling?
I feel all right.
Okay, great. Well, you're free to go then. And just remember that you need to have a second shot after 6 months. All right?
All right.
If every child received their HPV vaccination on schedule, that could prevent up to 90% of HPV-related cancers down the road, according to the American Cancer Society. That's an awful lot of adults who won't get cancer and won't have to wonder if a childhood vaccine could have prevented it.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
Back in July and August, WMRA aired a series of profiles under the title Women of Interest, and the most listened to story in that series was number 2 overall in 2017. It was a profile of Harrisonburg area midwife Misty Ward. Midwives have delivered babies for centuries, but in America, they mostly went underground as childbirth became medicalized in the 20th century. So, like many other midwives these days, Misty Ward, owner and founder of Brookhaven Women's Health and Natural Birthing Center just outside Harrisonburg, is a bit of a rebel, part of a growing movement to demedicalize childbirth. WMRA's Jesse Nadler brought us this profile back in August.
What you're hearing right now is the sound of childbirth moments after delivery at Brookhaven Natural Birthing Center just outside Harrisonburg. The mom delivered her baby, her third child, in a water bath. If the room sounds raucous, that's because it is. 10 people, not including Brookhaven staff, attended this birth. Grandmas, big brothers, children. The parents call their two older children over to the bathtub to introduce them to the newest member of the family.
Come say what it, come say what it is.
Daddy's
okay?
Gonna uncover and you and Roman are gonna say what it is. It's a girl! It's a girl!
A birth is by definition a lively event, and Brookhaven founder and owner, midwife Misty Ward, she actually caught this baby as it came out, likes to retain as much of that rough and tumble joy as possible.
The birth center philosophy is it's not a mini hospital, it's a maxi house.
Births aren't supposed to be clinical around here. Moms can invite their entire extended families into the birthing suites with them if they want. They want to eat a ham sandwich? Go ahead. The fully stocked kitchen at the heart of Brookhaven is specifically for laboring moms and their families.
So we have grandmas in here baking birthday cakes for the baby. Sometimes we have dads. I mean, we've had a guy make steak for all of our staff. That was a really good one.
The idea behind midwife-led maternity care is that women do better when they're able to deliver in a natural, home-like setting at their own pace, often in a water bath. And research seems to back this up. Doctors in the United Kingdom recommend that healthy women with low-risk pregnancies are actually better off staying out of the hospital. It results in lower rates of interventions, from cesareans to episiotomies. This is totally anathema in the United States, where the vast majority of women have hospital births. 60% have an epidural. 32% are cesarean deliveries, more than double the World Health Organization's target of 10 to 15%. The whole experience is invasive and sped up, says Ward.
Women are created to do this, and they can do it with the right support. And I just feel like the hospital's failing them in supporting them through a natural process. It's a lot of the things that
happen to women in a hospital that creates the need for the epidural.
Ward is part of a growing minority who think women are better off going au naturel. Around 9% of all births in the U.S. are led by midwives, up from about 3% in years past. When she first opened in 2010, she was delivering 40 babies a year. Now she's up to 100. More hospitals have linked up with midwives to meet the growing demand, but Brookhaven is still the only public freestanding natural birthing center in the area. She recently celebrated her 500th natural delivery.
Witnessing a baby come out of a woman, I mean, honestly, the fact that it fit, the fact that it worked, the fact that she was alive when it was all over, like, honestly, it's amazing that our bodies can create another human being. And even now, 500 plus births into it and gone through the process myself, I'm still just in awe of, like, what women's bodies can do. We make people.
Midwifery was the standard for delivering babies throughout history and one of the few occupations open to women. But in the United States, the practice was pushed underground and demonized as unsafe and backward as the medicalization of childbirth took over. By 1950, almost all U.S. babies were delivered by doctors, male doctors, in a hospital. Midwifery didn't go anywhere. It was just illegal. So it tended to draw women like Ward, who had a bit of a rebel spirit. It wasn't until 2006 that midwifery in Virginia became legal again.
I kind of wanted to call the shots, and I didn't want to be employed by someone else. You know, I wanted to own my own business. I'm just really motivated in that way. And
because there were so few professional midwives in Virginia when she first started, she apprenticed for months at a time in places such as Senegal, the Dominican Republic, and Texas along the border. It required leaving her own children, she now has three, for long periods of time with her mother.
The 9 weeks that I was in Texas, I didn't see them, but I would write them a letter every single day.
Ward's mother, long a home birth skeptic, became a champion of midwifery after witnessing Ward deliver her second child in her mom's own bathtub.
She actually said, "Wow, Misty, like what you just got, every woman deserves." And she said, "I feel like I was robbed of that experience," because her own births were traumatic and horrible and scary. And she was terrified of me giving birth in her home. But then after, she just like became my number one supporter.
But not everyone in the community was so enthusiastic. And home births are not recommended for high-risk pregnancies. When Ward went before the County Board of Supervisors in 2010 to apply for a zoning permit to open her business, she was reminded again that the medical establishment still had issues with her profession.
Then the board said, "Is there anyone here who opposes this?" And all of a sudden, I heard, "I do. I do. I do. I do."
Four medical professionals associated with Rockingham Memorial Hospital got up to voice their objections. Ward, ever the fighter, reminded the board that she was licensed by the Virginia Board of Medicine to practice anywhere in the state. If they didn't give her the permit, she'd just open in another location.
Then they were all like, "Oh, good point. We can't stop you from practicing."
They realized it was a turf war and gave her the permit. And after a few bumps, she says she now has a great working relationship with the hospital, which leads to one of the biggest misconceptions about a natural birthing center.
"We're not going to handcuff you to the bed and say you have to do this without drugs here, bite this stick. You know, if women want to have an epidural, we'll take them to the hospital, you know."
10% of her laboring clients end up doing exactly that. And for the record, she's not anti-epidural at all. She just thinks they're overused. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Jesse also filed the number one most listened to feature story last year. It attracted more than 5,000 visits on our website, and it was a profile of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ginsburg visited Virginia Military Institute in Lexington on February 1st last year, and that was significant because Justice Ginsburg had a profound impact on the school by writing the majority opinion in a landmark case that forced the all-male institute to admit women. The day before her visit to campus, Jesse filed this report examining the impacts of that case.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg doesn't really do public appearances. She's not known for giving interviews. So it's really telling that the 83-year-old justice is coming to VMI to speak before the entire Corps of Cadets on Wednesday. The VMI case is called United States versus Virginia, and Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion that found the state-run school's all-male admission policy to be unconstitutional. It's regarded as her most important decision on the high court.
The VMI case was in some ways the culmination of all of her work.
Erin Carmone is co-author of Notorious RBG.
Long before Justice Ginsburg was a Supreme Court justice, she was an important women's rights litigator. She co-founded the ACLU Women's Rights Project, and she actually transformed our constitutional understanding of gender. Before she got to work, it was completely illegal for the government to discriminate on the basis of gender.
VMI's remedy at the time was to start a sister program at Mary Baldwin. But Justice Ginsburg wrote that would be a pale shadow in terms of course offerings, faculty, funding, prestige, and alumni support for women. The ruling was met with major opposition from VMI's passionate alumni base and all-male core. But administrators knew they had to get on board to avoid the mistakes made by the Citadel when trying to assimilate women a few years prior. Here's VMI spokesman Stuart Mackinnis.
When the Supreme Court made that ruling, VMI embraced the ruling and set about doing the best job it could integrating women into the core.
They had no choice but to embrace the ruling, but that was it. The school wasn't going to change anything else.
VMI didn't like to use the word co-education.
Laura Brody is the author of Breaking Out, VMI and the Coming of Women. She was one of the few women to sit in on executive meetings regarding the transition at the time.
They said that the Supreme Court did not require them to create a system of education that was made for men and women. All the Supreme Court required of them was to let women enter their culture as it was.
The physical standards were exactly the same. The PT standards were exactly the same.
Gussie Lord, class of 01, was part of that first wave of female cadets. She was an English major and is now an environmental lawyer in D.C.
We were expected to, sort of act exactly like the guys did. And I think that's fine, but I think it's not realistic.
Still, she rose to the occasion.
Personally, I did feel like I had a responsibility from a feminist standpoint to do a good job to the women who would follow us, to sort of set the tone and set the standard and show that, we could succeed at VMI.
Today, women make up a mere 11% of the student body. So it is still pretty much a men's college. But for those who get through it, a VMI diploma, especially for women, can carry a lot of weight.
Some of the things she said in that case, for example, VMI having a reputation that provides specific benefits to its graduates, I think are true. I think my VMI diploma has opened up a lot of doors for me. My VMI experience has stayed with me. I always have been, and I always will be grateful to have had that experience.
Lord is one of a few female alumni who will be attending Wednesday's event. Army Major Angela Scott, class of 01, who now works for a general and heads to work at the Pentagon this summer, will be there with her two young daughters in tow.
At the time, I was too naive and sheltered to realize the impact that Justice Ginsburg had on everything and the impact she would have on my life. But I can tell you that since then, I've been a very quiet but passionate advocate for equal opportunity, not just for women, but across the board. So getting to see someone that had such a large part of igniting a fire in me is a pretty neat experience.
Wednesday's event is open to the public. Justice Ginsburg will also participate in a private event at Washington and Lee University's law school next door. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.